Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to an Intelligence Squared U.S. Oxford-style debating live from the Caspary Auditorium at the Rockefeller University. The motion before us tonight is Google violates its Don't Be Evil motto. We will be hearing from two teams of three panelists each in debate. This debate will take place in three parts. There will be opening statements followed by a round of direct debate among the panelists, and that will also include questions from you, the audience, and then we will have a brief period of summing up by each of the debaters. In the opening round, they are each given 7 minutes each, and we will have a warning sound for each panelist as they approach minute six. It will sound like this. Clear? And at 7 minutes, if the speaker has not finished speaking, it will sound like this. And on, and on it will go. This is a contest. It's a contest of wit and logic and ideas and persuasion. And you, the audience, are the prize in that contest. You are the judges, and your votes will determine who is the winner of the evening. And to that end, we're asking all of you at this point to express your view on the motion now, before having heard any of the actual debate and argument. You each have the keypad at your seat. If you agree with the motion that Google violates its Don't Be Evil motto, press button number one. If you disagree, press button number two. And if you are undecided, press button number three. I'll be sharing those results in a short time after we hear the opening round completed. Is anybody need more time? All right. Restating once again, this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, our fourth debate in the series, the premise is, the motion is that Google violates its Don't Be Evil motto. And you may have noticed that Google itself is not represented on our panel tonight. We suffice to say that the company was made aware of this debate and was invited to participate. Now let's let the debating begin. We're going first to argue for the motion, Randall Picker, a professor of commercial law at the University of Chicago Law School and a senior fellow at the Computation Institute of the University of Chicago. Ladies and gentlemen, Randall Picker.
Thank you very much. I want to thank Intelligence Squared and the Rosencrantz Foundation for organizing what I think will be a fun and lively evening. So, the resolution before us is that Google violates its Don't Be Evil motto. I think it's important for us to frame that and understand what that means and what it doesn't mean. The question isn't whether Google is a great company. I think it is. And I thought what Bob Rosencrantz said about it is exactly right. Much to admire. The question isn't whether Google does more good than evil. I think it does. That's not the question either. The question is whether we can identify certain things which they do, which we think are important to how Google operates, that are inconsistent with that motto. And I think we can. So we should start where that motto comes from. When Google was going to become a public company, it filed its registration statement. If you haven't read those, they're remarkably dull. Not Google's. Google opens with a owner's manual for future Google shareholders. Page and Brin say, we're not an ordinary company. We're not going to be an ordinary company. Get ready for the ride. Okay. And part of that is Google says, we're going to live by a motto. And that motto is we're not going to be evil. Seemingly asking us to hold Google to a higher standard. They're very clear. There will be times when they will sacrifice the short-run interests of Google for the public good. I don't think what's legal is the standard to evaluate for Google. Google asks us for something much more public interested. Google then compares itself to newspapers. Well, that's interesting, right? They seem to be on diverging paths, but I think they thought there was some sense of a public trust associated with newspapers, and we should hold Google to that as well. That's what we're going to try to do tonight. My piece of this is I'm going to focus on the heart of Google's business, which is their advertising model. And I'm going to focus on the recent deal that was proposed between Google and Yahoo, where Yahoo was going to outsource a large chunk of its search ad business to Google. I should say I consulted in connection with the opposition, so you can discount what I say as you wish. I should say we won. That's good news, because that deal has gone away. But Department of Justice suggested that they were going to challenge the deal in court. That was something clearly Google didn't want, so they backed away from it. All right. Advertisers were opposed to the deal. Why were advertisers opposed? Advertisers believed that the deal, and the core of the deal was, is if you think of search queries, there's a lot of common queries, there's a lot of unusual queries. The deal was going to outsource the long tail, as it were, Chris Anderson's term, of queries away from Yahoo to Google. Advertisers were upset about that. Why? Well, advertisers believed that prices were going to go up because of that. Google's response to that was to say, we run auctions. We don't set prices. Advertisers set prices. We're just middlemen. That's not right, and I think Google knows better. I should say, I'm a Google AdWords advertiser, so if you've not looked at the system, the way it works, you can set a count up very easily, pay $5 to do so. I'm advertising. I thought I should understand how AdWords works, so I'm advertising a paper that I wrote on antitrust and privacy and cloud computing. I'm not sure who the second click has been. But you see how that works, okay? So you can click and go. But the nature of this is that you bid on keyword terms. If you win the auction, your ads are supposed to show up. Now, Google understands that how you design auctions matters, right? There's a whole field of economics devoted to that. We gave William Vickrey from Columbia a Nobel Prize for that. Google is designing its auctions in a way that takes advantage of its market power. Does that in three important ways. First, Google runs a system involving minimum bids. So cloud neutrality is one of the terms that I'm bidding on. You can run a search on cloud neutrality. I did yesterday. I know my ad is out there. It didn't show up. Indeed, no ad showed up. And indeed, if you look at the statistics, 50% of the time when you run a search on Google and they produce results, the organic search results, there are no ads next to it. Even though, if you believe the comments, and as I say, I'm one of these AdWords advertisers, my ad is out there waiting to be served, and even though the search that has been done, if they don't run an ad, it's an opportunity to show an ad which is lost forever. So there's a chance for Google to get money there, and yet they're not doing it. Why? Because if very few people are bidding, then I ought to be able to buy it for a very low price, and Google's interest is not served by that. Google wants to make sure that there's a high enough minimum. They've been raising the minimums over time such that Google meaningfully makes money on that. If you look at the blogs, people comment on this. They talk about bidding against the house. That's what they have to do. And Google has changed the terms in which they do that. Okay? That's an exercise in market power. I should say under current U.S. antitrust law, one of the things I do for a living, I don't think that's illegal. Evil? Well, that's the resolution for the house tonight. That's one. Two, if you're an auctioneer, the way you exercise market power is you control the number of slots, right? You don't control prices, you control quantities. In Google's case, that means how many slots are available on the right-hand side next to the organic search results. Google controls that. Now, you might think in a competitive model that we'd have some relationship between the number of ads on Yahoo and on the number of ads on Google. Indeed, the central premise of the Yahoo-Google deal was that Google does a better job of ad matching than Yahoo does. We should therefore expect Google to have more ads than Yahoo, just the opposite. Again, market power being exercised, not illegal, evil, you decide. Finally, third point. Google engages in a kind of bundling. So Google also organizes search for Ask and AOL. You can buy Google alone. You can't buy Ask and AOL alone. They are bundled together with Google, right? Advertisers would like to be able to advertise separately on those. You can't do it. They won't let you do that. Illegal under U.S. law, EU law? Maybe. We'll see, right? Evil? I think you can conclude. Now, why should we care about this, right? The importance of advertising is the way that advertising supports paid content, right? You should care a lot about the kind of content that's out there. And to the extent that the middleman is making it more expensive for people to reach consumers, we're going to have less content because producers are effectively going to get a lower chunk of the advertising dollars. I'll stop there. Thank you.
Thank you, Randy Picker. Our next speaker, speaking against the motion in this U.S. Intelligence Squared debate, Jim Harper, who, though arguing on this side, is not somebody unconcerned about privacy. In fact, when he was a consultant for the Department of Homeland Security, he argued vociferously against the introduction of a national identity card on privacy grounds. As director of Information Policy Studios at the Cato Institute, he is our second speaker, speaking against the motion that Google violates its Don't Be Evil motto. Jim Harper.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, it takes a lawyer to know a lawyer. And as a lawyer, I want to point out what my colleague just did at the beginning of his talk. He redefined the question. The question tonight is whether Google violates its Don't Be Evil motto. The question is whether Google is evil or not. And that's what I want to talk to you about, and I want to urge you to vote no on the resolution. To find that Google is evil, you have to find that people who cut in line are evil. You have to find that bruised apples are evil. You have to find that flat tires are evil. These things are not evil. Evil is Hitler. Evil is Stalin. Evil is Pol Pot. Evil is Dr. Evil. That's somewhat definitional. Google is not evil. Now, you have to make some sense of the term to understand these concepts. Now, perhaps that phrase was intended in a sort of let's not be a greasy corporation sense. Even by that standard, Google is not evil. Google is great. Google brings information and empowerment to the masses in ways we couldn't have imagined just a few years ago. Try it now. Think about how you would have found out information just a few years ago. It's a little hard to remember for oldsters like me, but it was very hard. Today it's much easier. Now there are lots of complaints about Google. Holders of copyrights say, Google's making use of my copyrights and my property. And da-da. In fact, Google is making that material more available and more valuable for copyright holders. Holders of trademarks complain precisely because Google is using trademarks in an appropriate way, in AdSense, allowing providers to compare their products with other products, bringing consumers lower prices, better products. This is good. This is not evil. Now, surely Google should avoid censorship. And one of the toughest areas is the question of censorship. But the Chinese people are better off with Google in China slow walking their cooperation with the Chinese government than having no Google in China and leaving China to Baidu and whatever local information sources are fully government approved. On the question of privacy, it's true that Gmail, Basic Search, Maps, Street View, all of these things challenge privacy. All of these things are challenges to privacy, but no more than any other apps that are available similarly. This is not a case that Google is evil. Perhaps it's a case that the internet is evil, but I don't think anybody here thinks that the internet is truly evil. Now, some say that Google's monopoly on search gives it so much power that this is inherently somehow evil. Well, Google has a sizable percentage of the search market. I think that's an admission I can make. But Google is a big company that's part of an information big bang that's far bigger. Google cannot control us finding out about things. Google cannot prevent criticisms of Google being made. Google's a big player, but the market is much, much bigger than Google. There's a more concerning evil that I want to point you to, and I know none of you indulge this, but some people who have problems with the way products and services are delivered do nothing but complain. That's the evil of apathy. If my colleagues at the far end of the table wish to characterize Google as evil, they should forswear the use of Google products and find the other products, which there are, and use those instead. Google's not evil. In fact, Google's not evil. Google's Evel Knievel. Google's high-flying. Google makes some mistakes. But Google is an American success story. Let me urge you once again to vote no on the proposition. Thank you.
Thank you, Jim Harper. Arguing next for the motion, Harry Lewis, a professor of computer science in the School of Engineering and Applied Sciences at Harvard University, who has something to disclose. Though he's arguing this side of the motion, his daughter is actually a Google employee. Harry Lewis.
Thank you. Thank you all for being here tonight. What a great audience. I have a very simple way of stating my case for the motion. And it's a conclusion that's based on some facts. Facts are good. So here are a few facts. If you Google Tibetan independence, you'll get back pointers to some sites that advocate the freedom of Tibet from Chinese rule. Tibet.org, friendsoftibet.org, sites associated with the Dalai Lama, and others. You'll also get back some sites that advocate against the freedom of Tibet from Chinese rule. That's if you go home tonight and use the version of Google that you have available to you in this country. But if you do it inside China, you won't get references to Tibet.org or friendsoftibet.org, except perhaps for references to sites explaining that those are illegal and banned organizations. Or Epoch Times. Epoch Times is a Chinese newspaper, an uncensored Chinese newspaper. You can find it on the internet, just Google Epoch Times. But try to do that in China, and you will not find your way to Epoch Times. Same thing with human rights, if you Google that, or various spiritual practices. The world looks very different through the window that Google provides in China than through the window on the world that you have available to yourselves here. In fact, it's not the picture window on the world. It's a distorted lens that has been built, custom built, by Google to Chinese specifications. Now, how did that happen? Google is the company whose mission is to organize the world's information and to make it universally accessible and useful. How did it come to be in the business of creating the distorting lens rather than the picture window on the world? Well, in 2004, Google was entering the international market. It wanted to be the number one search engine in the world. It started to do business in China. And the Chinese said, we don't want you to show our citizens the world as it really is, with all of its complexities and its contradictions and its inconsistent sources of information. We want the Chinese citizens to know the world the way we want them to know the world. And Google said, okay, we'll give them that world instead of the world as it really is. Their choice was to accept the Chinese ultimatum or to go home. They could have gone home. They didn't. They stayed and built the engine as the Chinese wanted it. Now, it's a wonderful product. I agree with everything that's been said about what a wonderful product it is and what a wonderful company it is. But here it's been turned from a wonderful product that we know into an instrument of thought control. Now, some may weakly claim that it's doing more good than harm, that the Chinese people are better off getting partial information via the Google search window than getting no information at all. That's nonsense. There are other search engines to which you can get the censored truth if that's what you want people to provide. Google didn't choose the lesser of two evils when faced with the Chinese ultimatum. It chose the more profitable of the two evils. And for that reason, you should vote for the proposition that Google is violating its don't be evil motto. They had a simple choice that was put before them. I stopped a street vendor here in New York last week who was selling Tibetan jewelry. He was a Tibetan. And I said, I'm going to debate this issue. What do you think the answer is? I didn't have to explain it to him. He knew exactly that Google works differently inside China than it does here. And here is what he said. He said Google had a choice between morality and money, and it chose money. That's why Google is violating its "Don't Be Evil" motto. It's a company that does many good works. It's true that that Google as a whole is not evil. I'll grant that, but that's not the question before us. If the question before us was Google is evil, that's what the question would be. That isn't the question. The question is, does it violate what it claims about not being evil? A good indicator that you're doing something wrong is that the Congress hauls your executives in front of them and yells at you. And Congress has gotten into the habit of doing this several times. Most recently in May, Senator Richard Durbin confronted Google executives on this censorship question and said, "When you're asked to be complicit in restricting the flow of information, aren't your hands a little dirty at the end of the day if you participate in that? There is legislation under consideration to prohibit exactly what Google is doing." Now, to be sure, Google is in the business to make money. If it doesn't sell advertising anywhere, then it's not going to make money, but it's making plenty of money. And it would have been such a statement to the international world about the importance of information freedom. My friends, you are here tonight because you value the robust debate of conflicting ideas. You value facts. You believe the truth is revealed through this kind of debate and conflict. You must vote for this proposition if you support the idea that creating censorship tools is a form of evil. Finally, just let me close with one analogy. Suppose Google were not a search engine company, but a pharmaceutical company, and it was told by the Chinese government that it could sell aspirin in China only if it also made certain forms of brainwashing drugs and thought control medications. And that was the condition on which it would sell aspirin in China. No responsible American company would make that deal with the Chinese authorities. And that is exactly what Google is doing in the digital realm. So please vote for the motion. Google violates its "Don't Be Evil" model because they do. Thank you.
But not your daughter. Okay. Just a reminder, as we're now halfway through our opening statements, I'm John Donvan, your host and moderator, and in this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, we're halfway through opening statements. You have heard from three panelists, and we're moving on to our next three. And speaking next against the motion that Google violates its "Don't Be Evil" motto, Esther Dyson, who also has some things to disclose, but having met her earlier, I know she'll do it far better than I will. I'll only share the fact that among all of your other activities as an investor in various internet enterprises, you're also currently frequently visiting Russia because you are in training to be a cosmonaut.
Correct. So I was going to start by saying that I actually spend a fair amount of time with things I consider evil. And I mean that quite seriously. The old Soviet system, which you still see some vestiges of in Star City where I'm training, I travel a lot. I've seen many ways to be evil. I've examined governments, talked to people who... I'm on the board of the National Endowment for Democracy, and we give grants to dissidents. So that informs my thinking, as does the fact that I was chairman of ICANN, which is the organization that sets policy for the internet. We made a lot of mistakes. I don't think we were evil, but we probably came a lot closer to it than Google ever did or will. But finally, in terms of the disclosures you probably want to know, I'm on the board of 23andMe, which was co-founded by Sergey Brin's wife. I'm on the board of WPP Group, which calls Google its frenemy or its fro. They're a large advertising conglomerate. But finally, I'm on the board of Yandex, which competes with Google in Russia, where Yandex has 60% market share and Google has approximately 20. So I kind of come at this from many different points of view. And I believe that Google does not violate its don't be evil motto, because I've seen it up close. I've also seen it from outside. I've seen it as a competitor. I've seen how they try to do things. And I am very glad to hear all this discussion of China, because I'm going to blow it to bits in a few moments. But first, I want to go through the couple of arguments I wanted to talk about. The challenge of power is great. The great virtue of the internet is that it erodes power. It sucks power out of the center and takes it to the periphery. It erodes the power of institutions over people while giving to individuals the power to run their own lives. Google is part of that. It's one of these things that shines light on everything. It enables people to find stuff out. It enables them to question what their governments are doing. And it's absolutely wonderful. That doesn't mean that power cannot be abused. The abuse of power is absolutely evil. Google, to some extent, understands this very well. That's why they bothered to have this motto in the first place. They understand the danger of concentration of power, and they understand how important it is not to be evil. That's why they have shareholder agreements that give them more power so that they don't need to cater only to money-hungry investors, but can also do what they think is right. There are three people who set policies there. It's the two founders and Eric Schmidt. And they watch one another. They're very careful not to abuse this don't be evil thing. Now, the power that Google has is primarily a good power, though it could be used to do evil. It's not like atom bombs. It's not like guns or even cigarettes, which when used correctly are destructive. The power of transparency, the power of knowledge, is fundamentally good, even though it can on occasion be used for bad. And so Google's trust is to ensure that that power is used for good as much as possible. I have seen what they're doing in China. And ladies and gentlemen, the reason they're not violating their don't be evil policy is because they're in there and they're engaged. Yes, they could abdicate. They could say, we're not going to bother to go into China. But every time some Chinese person uses Google and doesn't get what he wants, he may notice. He may not even notice the absence. But he does know that he can go find out all the negative information on George Bush he wants. And at some point, he or she says, well, gee, if I can get, or whatever the Chinese version is, if I can get this bad information about George Bush, why can't I find out more about what's going on in my own country? Google, by its very presence and its operation, even if it's incomplete, creates increasing expectations for transparency. It starts people answering questions. It gets them to expect to be able to find out stuff. And it knows that by doing that, people are going to start asking more questions. So I think Google is doing the right thing by going into China. I don't think they're making that much money there. If they are, that's fine too. But the point of it is they are engaging. I know another example in which they're getting engaged. They have a service, you've probably encountered it, where if you go to a website, if you get a search result that indicates a website that may have some malware on it, they warn you off. This is very expensive for them to do. They need to detect the sites with malware. They need to inform them that there's malware. They have a dispute resolution process. They're not perfect. But again, they're engaging where they didn't need to. They could easily have just passed the query through. But they're trying to make the world a better place by doing something that requires them to make judgments. Sometimes they may incorrectly flag a site as having malware. Sometimes somebody has malware unintentionally. They need to deal with it. So the point here, again, is that rather than just being apathetic, as Jim said, they're engaging and trying to make the world a better place. So I believe that they do not violate their motto, and I think you should vote against the proposition. Thank you.
Thank you, Esther Dyson. Our next speaker runs a blog, the name of which will tell you a great deal. It is googlizationofeverything.com. Sivavite Hayanathan is Associate Professor of Media Studies and Law at the University of Virginia, and he is also turning his blog ultimately into a book, the kind of book that depends on paper and dead trees, I assume. Siva, the floor is yours.
Thank you very much. To my distinguished opponents, I see your Dr. Evil and your Dr. Pol Pot, and I raise you a pope and a poet, specifically Pope Gregory the Great and the great poet Dante Alighieri. Because after all, one of the things we have to figure out here is, what do we mean by evil? Well, Google encourages us to think algorithmically. After all, it's built everything that it has on algorithms. One of the simplest forms of algorithms, the if-then statement, or if you prefer, the checklist. Dante offers us such a checklist in the Divine Comedy. I know you know it. I know you know it with me, so say it along with me. The seven deadly sins: luxuria, gula, avaritia, assedia, ira, invidia, and superbia, right? Well, okay, you didn't say it along with me. To walk through, I can show you that Google has at times committed every single one of these seven deadly sins. The first, luxuria, which translates as extravagance or lust. I spent a bit of time on the Google campus out in California. They get massages, right? The people who work there get massages. That is corporeal lust of the highest order, or at least for a bunch of geeks about the best they're going to do. Number two, gula, or gluttony. The other thing about the Google campus is they get incredible food, all they can eat, all day. No matter what they want, there is so much food that they never need to say no. That is the very definition of gluttony. Number three, avaritia, greed. We've already heard from Randy about the greed embodied in the Google-Yahoo advertising deal. That is one of many examples of Google overreaching to corner a market or completely undermine a market in an effort to maximize its returns. Number four, assedia, sloth. Now, I could talk about how lazy and self-satisfied Google was in its effort to roll out an online video service. The early days of Google Video were very much a matter of figuring they owned the video realm, and they weren't actually going to do anything new or fantastic until these whippersnappers at YouTube came across with their flash video platform and basically ran around them to the point where they ended up having to buy that company just to keep pace. But there's actually a better example of sloth, and that is that Google itself, its very nature, its very model of advertising is based on free riding. Google makes money off of our work. We blog, we put our cats on skateboards and record them for videos. We do all of this work, and then Google harvests our work, runs all of this content through its computers, spits it back out at us with almost no actual value added, and what we end up getting is a tremendous amount of money based on free riding, the very definition of sloth. Wrath, ira, wrath. There are a number of high-profile cases of people who have been involved with Google through their AdSense program, through which they've agreed to place ads on their own blogs. I think Jeff is one of these people, but not one who has suffered the wrath of Google. Many of these people have found their accounts shut down, their revenue stopped, for reasons that can never be explained, but they did something to violate Google's policies, but they get no feedback and no response and no justice. And then there are hundreds of small companies all around America that have found their ranks decimated, their Google ranks declined significantly, because again, they tried to optimize their results. They were just doing what a company should do, trying to get more attention for themselves. And Google's algorithms, its faceless, soulless algorithms, came at them with wrath, another of the seven deadly sins. Nvidia, envy. Google has, over the last few years, engaged in a series of efforts to try to muscle in on the markets of other successful companies, Microsoft being the most prominent. Google has recently tried to push its its suite of services that directly compete with Microsoft Office. Of course, they have at various times threatened to muscle out eBay, muscle out PayPal, muscle out Amazon in various ways. Number seven, the one I want to talk about the most, Superbia, pride or hubris. Now, let me remind you of the actual motto of the company. It's not do no evil or don't be evil. It's actually to organize the world's information and make it universally accessible. What could be more hubristic than that? What could be more prideful than that? General Motors doesn't say we're going to organize all the places in the country and make them universally accessible. General Motors says we're going to try to sell cars. Not that that's the best example to use this week, I understand. Nonetheless, no company besides Google would ever come up with a motto or a mission statement like that. But let me tell you something that Sergey Brin, one of the founders of Google, said a number of years ago during an interview when someone asked him, what would the perfect search engine be like? And he said, without missing a beat, it would be like the mind of God. Ladies and gentlemen, that's more than hubris. That's blasphemy. Now, the particular kind of hubris that energizes Google is, of course, a sense of techno-fundamentalism, the notion that you can always invent something to solve the problem that the last invention created. And that faith in technology, that technology can cover all of our sins and all of our faults and fix all of our problems, is, again, the ultimate hubris. It's the hubris expressed in the myth of Pandora, for instance, the myth of having too much knowledge. There are so many examples in which, in human history, in which techno-fundamentalism has led to great suffering. Not that Google is about to lead us to great suffering, but they're still committing the sin of hubris. Now, hubris is actually the most serious of the seven deadly sins. As Dante explains to us, it was the sin that Lucifer committed. Lucifer was a good guy. Lucifer fell because he thought he could be as effective as God, as good as God, and thus he became Satan. The very notion of the don't be evil motto is itself hubristic, is itself evil, because it is itself a violation of the seven deadly sins. One real-world example, let me finish with very quickly, Google Book Search. Google has been trying to scan in 36 million books from libraries around the world in an effort to essentially corner the market on digital book access for a number of years. Early on, 4 years ago, when it started this project or got public with this project, it claimed that everything was cool as far as copyright was concerned. In other words, copyright only applies to mere mortals, not to superhuman, super companies like Google. Well, it turns out Google wasn't right about that. Last month, Google ended up having to settle and wrote a check for $125 million to publishing authors because it turns out they weren't quite as on the ball about copyright as they thought. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Siva Vaidyanathan. Our final speaker against the motion, Jeff Jarvis, has had a foot in the what we call the legacy media as a co-founding editor of Entertainment Weekly magazine. He was also a TV critic for TV Guide and for People. But of late, he has been very much of the blogosphere with a blog called BuzzMachine.com, and he also teaches interactive journalism at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. Jeff Jarvis.
And I guess in both full disclosure and a plug, I should say I have a book coming out called What Would Google Do?
Very hubristic.
Yeah. You're just jealous. A massage would feel good right now, wouldn't it? We should remember where this pledge came from. The chiefs of Google have said that the real purpose of the Don't Be Evil pledge is to give employees the license to remind their bosses of this in meetings. So a geek can stand there and say, is that evil? The kind of thing a geek would say. And it's useful. Imagine, ladies and gentlemen, if we had that phrase, don't be evil, chiseled over every door on Wall Street. Would we not have a better world today? In this poison process that led to the financial crisis, if just one or two or five or 10 people had said, taking poison mortgages or giving them, is that evil? Creating poison assets and selling them, is that evil? So I think it's important to just recognize that the rule itself is good. The fact that Google asks it is good. And we should wish that It shouldn't be special subject of a debate that a company promises not to be evil. The fact that it's special is itself a virtue. So I would like to match the seven deadly sins with eight, I'll beat you, virtues of Google. And let's remember that virtue does leaven evil. We all mess up, right? So virtue matters. So number one, Google has opened up, as my colleagues have said, the world's knowledge to the world, or stipulated China, most of the world's knowledge to most of the world. And that's important. It has changed our very view of facts and knowledge and accuracy. No longer do we end an argument saying, I don't know. We go to Google. Google will tell us. And it will tell us that in the blink of an eye. Now, in fact, I went to Google and I asked Google, how fast does an eye blink? And it told me in 0.3 seconds that an eye blinks in 0.3 seconds. Your life is richer now because of Google. Number two, Google respects the wisdom of the crowd. We are too often not respected. There's a snobbishness about my old colleagues in big old media. Google doesn't have that. Google learns what it learns because it trusts us. Isn't that nice? Shouldn't companies do that? Shouldn't politicians do that? Wouldn't trust matter? Google, in its very essence, trusts us. Number three, Google takes the wisdom of the crowd. It knows we have wisdom, and it gives it back to us. It gives us our own knowledge. Look at the Google flu trends search. It lets us know how often we search for flu and how the flu trend is coming. That is our knowledge. It's not Google's. Google shares our own knowledge with us. It gives us back. It does add value, if not to flaming cat videos, to our own wisdom. Google connects people. This is so important. We often are accused online of being antisocial. I think we've become hypersocial. I think we're more connected. I met Esther and Siva because of Google, because of searches. I looked at Google and there's Siva on the other side. And so I think the importance of Google connecting people cannot be underestimated. Our children today connect in ways across cultures we don't even know. Yes, sometimes it makes us nervous, but I think that it can only be good. Admit it. How many of you have searched Google for an old girlfriend or boyfriend? Oh, come on, you liars. Now, part of the problem is, I can say this because I have gray hair, that probably the probability of finding someone is inverse proportional to your age. But young people will stay connected to their friends for the rest of their lives. Imagine the impact that will have on friendship and society, and Google is the mechanism that makes that happen. Five, Google creates platforms. It is a platform that enables us to create. A recent poll said 80% of Americans think they have a book in them. We should be glad that most don't come out. But we have seen in Google that it is an age of creation, and Google creates the platforms, the tools to let us create, the means to let us pay for that. I think that's very, very important. Six, Google does have ads. Last year, I made a big $4,500 in Google ads. I shouldn't have quit the day job, I know. But if you want to compare, my dear colleagues on the other side, the view of Google toward its advertising structure, compare it to a monopoly newspaper, which set the price, which set its own rules, which allowed you to only do so many things with their space. Well, no, we can do what we want with our ads. We can start whole businesses with it. We can create movements with it. We can be found with it. That's important. And I believe that Google Ads will help support the future even of news. Seven, Google.org, the foundation started by Google, is supported by 1% of the equity and 1% of the profits of the company. And it is trying to solve, with hubris, the problem of energy and global warming in one fell swoop. But I've learned that they're doing it in a uniquely techno-smart way. The way engineers do. Engineers solve problems. We have a problem. They're looking for the solution. Politicians are trying to get us on energy with regulation and taxes and prohibitions and slaps on the wrist. Google is giving this investment and innovation and invention. And if it can solve the problem of power cheaper than coal, then we don't have to save anymore. We can use as much as we want. Google understands abundance. Finally, eight, Google has a new model on how to treat employees. They get massages. Finally, I want to say that Google teaches us to understand our new world in new ways. And if we are too critical of Google, I think we give up that opportunity to see this new world and understand it through the lens of Google. In this new economy, I don't think the companies will be built anymore by huge capital making huge acquisitions. They will be built as Google has through networks and platforms. We have a lot to learn from Google. As we try to understand this new world of links and connectedness and platforms and networks and generosity and speed, we would do well to ask ourselves, what would Google do? Google is not evil. In the examples it gives, and in the fact that it vows not to be evil, Google is a model to us all. Our world is better off because we have Google. So please, have a moment of decency and vote against the motion.
Thank you, Jeff Jarvis. That concludes our opening round, and in a minute or two, I'm going to turn to you and ask whoever is there seething to respond to something you've heard that just outrages you to do so, and we will also shortly be turning to questions from the audience. But I want to restate our motion that Google violates its don't be evil motto, and as you know, when you came in this evening, we asked you to vote for your opinion on this motion. And we have the numbers now, which I'm about to reveal, numbers which will appear on Google in perpetuity from this moment forward. Before the debate, 21% of you agreed with the motion, 31% of you were against the motion, and 48% of you were undecided. And that 48% is very valuable. It's one of the largest undecided votes we've seen so far this season, maybe the largest. And again, reminding you that this is a contest for changing minds, so that 48% is a very, very large pie to cut up. And we will be asking you to vote a little bit later on again in the evening. But first, I want to turn to you, and I'll count to three to see if a hand goes up, if anybody... Oh, okay. Harry Lewis, motion.
I'd just like to point out that our opposition has tried both tactics to persuade you to vote against the motion. They've said that evil means Hitler, Pol Pot, and the worst gulags of the Soviet Union. And they've also said, no, they mean by evil something that's a much higher standard. Now, I would like to think, and I would like to ask the opposition if they don't think that when Google made their motion, made their motto, don't be evil, that they were not holding them to the standard that they shouldn't be as evil as Pol Pot, Hitler, and the worst of the Soviet Union, and anything better than that, they would get a pass on the don't be evil.
Jim Harper, take that on. Jim Harper speaking for the motion.
Now, the question is as to the motto, and I spoke to both versions, the actual genuine meaning of the word evil, but what they may have meant, which is the sort of corporate greed kind of thing. Greed, which as Siva pointed out, drives them wrongly, apparently, to compete with eBay and Microsoft and Amazon. That's not an indictment of a company to say that they're competing with others, trying to serve consumers better than with whom they compete. By any standard, Google is not violating the don't be evil policy that they put forward.
Jim, your teammate Esther Dyson.
Yeah, the purpose of this motto is that these guys are smart and they are aware of the possibility of evil. They are aware that their extraordinary success and their extraordinary ability to collect information gives them a lot of power, and they do not want to abuse it. The other thing I'd like to point out is that using Google is voluntary. Pol Pot, all these dictators, they were not voluntary. Google, whether it wanted to be evil or not, is constrained by the forces of competition, and it's well aware of that. It has to earn your favor. It discloses to you what it does with your information. You can go and search your web history. So they're using their power to do good and to make the world more transparent.
Siva, you want to jump in?
Yeah. Jim, you've fallen into my trap.
Siva, can you just close to your mic a little bit?
Of course. So you've fallen into my trap by citing the fact that every company should be expected to compete and should, in fact, probably be extravagant, be gluttonous, be greedy, be slothful, be wrathful, and be envious, and, of course, hubristic. Every company should, because that's what companies should do. They should compete. They should win. They should crush.
No, they should win. They should not crush.
Siva, you've fallen into your own bomb.
And by that I say, it is for the companies to violate the seven deadly sins and not to pretend they don't. And it is for popes and poets to warn us against it.
Randy Picker. Let me bring in Randy Picker for the motion.
I hate to be a textualist, but I brought the registration statement with me, right? Let's see what it says. Don't be evil. We believe strongly that in the long term we will be better served as shareholders and in all other ways by a company that does good things for the world, even if we forego some short-term gains. The question is, when does Google, faced with a conflict between what's good for the world, sacrifice its own interests? I don't think it's doing that.
Jeff Jarvis?
Let's look at Yahoo. May it rest in peace.
Yes.
Shall we have a moment of silence for Jerry Yang, dearly departed?
Not good radio. Continue.
Yes. Yahoo was the last old structure, the last old media company. Google is a new company. Eric Schmidt was asked recently by Jim Cramer how much they could make by putting ads on their homepage. Some untold billions of dollars, he said. They chose not to do that. Is that good versus evil? I actually argue it is, because Google recognizes that it's not an end like Yahoo. It's not an old media company. It's a new media company that gets us to what we want to get to. That itself is a virtue. I think the problem we're having here is defining the fall from grace. And if we all define it the way you are trying to hold Google, then we're all going to hell. Because
this has been a very theological evening so far.
That word evil does it.
WWGD. And so I think that Google recognizes that life is a beta. Google puts out products and says they're not done yet. They are wrong. They're incomplete. Please help us fix them. Google is not trying to say that they are ultimately absolutely virtuous. If we all tried to define ourselves that way, we'd be doomed.
Siva.
So Jeff has compared Google to Wall Street firms and said, wouldn't it be great if Wall Street firms had that motto chiseled in their buildings? He's compared Google to newspapers that have local monopolies and pointed out that newspapers, of course, fix prices on advertising. And now he's compared Google to Yahoo. None of that matters. It does not matter that any other company behaves badly or behaves in an evil way, because none of those companies ever were foolish enough to chisel such a motto into their buildings or their financial filing statements. Now, that the fact is
should they
that
have,
Google
should
has
they
set
have.
Its own standard and has not met its own standard.
It has set its own standard, and I believe it has met it. It has aspired to do good. It has, as I said, engaged in an evil world to make it better. To me, that's the opposite of evil.
Harry Lewis, do you think Google actually meant it when it said that it wanted to commit no evil, or was that the most cynical declaration of all time?
It was an aspirational statement.
They meant it.
And just as many of us make promises that we have to acknowledge we are unable to keep, Google has been unable, virtuously and continuously, to keep its aspirational promise. I think it's a good thing that Google made that aspirational promise. The question is whether it ever violates it, and the answer is plainly that it does.
Esther, you were talking about China. Harry says going to China, and essentially he's saying collaborating with the regime, and I choose all of those words because that's exactly what his point was, it was an act of evil. And you're arguing that a little access is a good thing.
A little access is a good thing, but I'm arguing something more important. It's not collaborating with the regime. It is infiltrating the regime. It is spreading information within China. It's exposing people to the virtues of knowledge. It's changing their expectations. It's creating more transparency. Long run, you will see that Google is going to change China by opening those cracks. Every time you open a crack and insert something in it, it starts to crumble.
We're going to hear from your teammate, Jeff Jarvis, in just a moment because he has something he wants to say. But at this point, I'd like to bring the house lights up. And if you have questions, raise your hands, and we have folks with microphones circulating. I know that there are some journalists in the audience, and we're happy to have your questions. We just would ask that you'd identify yourself. And if some in some other way you have some dog in the fight, in a way that you would like to disclose, that would be a good thing, too.
No, we believe in disclosure regardless.
Jeff Jarvis.
Even if you wish that Google did differently in China, And frankly, I do. I wish they used their power. The important thing is to realize the basis upon which they made this decision. And they used their Don't Be Evil pledge as a basis to debate and decide this. They made their decision, not out of pure greed, but out of the belief, agree with it or disagree with it, but out of the belief that they were trying to do good.
Let's go to a question halfway up, and again, passing the microphone down, and reminding you of our disclosure requests.
Right, so my name's Larry Lessig. I'm a professor at Stanford. And Stanford gets lots of money from Google for some reasons, I don't know why. First a comment to Siva and then a question for Harry. The comment for Siva is, it's not actually true to say, Siva, that Google paid $125 million for something that it originally claimed it could do for free. It paid $125 million to do something far beyond what it originally claimed fair use protected it to do. And it explicitly says in the agreement that it does not believe that its original fair use claims are false, as I believe its fair use claims are true. So what it's done is just bought a right that before it never claimed. This is not
for people who are unaware of the settlement, could you take three sentences to explain?
Long sentences? I'm a lawyer, so.
Yeah, but I think you can do it. You're talking about the publishing.
Right. So Google originally claimed it had the right to scan these 18 or 36 million books.
One sentence.
And at least make available snippets of the books that were still in copyright,
comma,
but out of print, period. The settlement gives Google the right to display 20% of a book, plus if a user chooses to then give user access to the full book if they pay. That is wildly more than anybody thought Siva, fair use would grant
we'll
them
come
the
to
right
your second
to
question. I want Siva to respond to that.
Yeah,
because basically, what's wrong with, especially since a lot of these millions of books were out of print, that you couldn't get to unless you traveled halfway across the world to a dusty library, and what you can now get online.
I don't want to argue that making this material available is an example of evil. What was evil was the hubris in arguing that they could fly above the basics of copyright when they do it. And Larry and I have had this argument going on for about 4 years. We don't want to invite everyone else into it. Nonetheless, we're at loggerheads on. But I do want to point out that of the $125 million that Google willfully paid in the settlement, people don't give away money for nothing. They basically were paying the authors and the publishers $91 million to settle the damages that were claimed by the authors and publishers, right? Simple math. No something for nothing. The extra services that Google is now providing will take up $34 million of that $125 million. So, in fact, the settlement was a concession that they probably had flown too close to the
Randy
sun.
Picker wants to add to that.
So don't focus on the dollars. Focus on a different issue. So the basic structure of copyright law is subject to fair use, you have to get permission. Google has done something incredibly clever, evil, I don't know, in the settlement, which is by turning it into an opt-out class action, and now I just said a bunch of legal words that you're not going to like, right? They've effectively changed the default position with regard to how copyright's consent system works. That's either brilliant because of the orphan works problem, clever, or evil, I don't know.
But bottom line, for those of us who aren't lawyers and don't know the terms of the debate.
Yeah.
Did Google serve its own interests in this deal?
Very much so, I think. Maybe the public interest at the same time.
Larry, from the audience, you had a question.
It also served the interests of people who want to read books that
Absolutely.
Were no
and
longer
authors
available.
To write them. Yes.
And authors to get payments.
Larry, to your question.
But to the question to Harry. So you observe that your reason for calling your daughter's company evil is that...
Thanks a lot. She'll love me for that.
...is that it complies with the Chinese rules about censoring a certain class of speech.
Right.
During the political campaign that we've just ended, John McCain complained to YouTube, part of Google, that YouTube was complying with American copyright laws and censoring a whole bunch of speech that he thought should be kept up on the internet. Now, would you say a company is evil when it complies with American law and censors speech, or is it, a company obliged to keep all speech available regardless of the local law that might control it?
In the case of John McCain, I'm actually with John McCain in wishing that YouTube would exercise a little more judgment before it automatically pulled the campaign videos down.
although I understand the practical reasons why that's important, and I understand why under the safe haven rules they would have the knee-jerk reaction. But Google actually could afford to review some of those videos in the middle of a political campaign to make a judgment about whether there were fair use or not, and I wish they had.
I'm curious, does the audience agree with that? Those who agree, just a round of applause to that. And those who don't agree? Those who don't agree? About 50-50. We're going to go to another question up on the halfway up. Who is there? Okay, we have one down front to your left here, please. And again, I will applaud a very cogent question.
I've written it down, actually.
Excellent.
Just, I'm John Soppy. I work for King Features, which is an online company. And I must say, someone brought up the point, if you put don't be evil over financial services companies, somehow they're miraculously going to think that they're not going to be evil. I think that people that are involved with the mortgage industry and the credit default sweeps, I still think to this day they probably are doing probably the benefit and the goodness of the financial services. So here's my question. If Google is willing to limit search to get market share, what would limit them from disclosing personal search information of citizens to gain or maintain a market share?
Jeff Jarvis. Great question when you got to it, by the way.
With all respect, I think you're showing little faith in mankind. It's not Google you have a problem with, but man. Yes, even in a financial organization, there can be someone who would ask the question and force the issue, is this evil? And similarly in Google, there is not only that, but there is also the self-interest that Google does have a brand and a reputation. And if Google messes with us, we can use the internet and find ourselves on Google to get Google back, and we will. So Google, in its enlightened self-interest, I believe, would not mess with us.
Okay, just a time check on where we are. We're about halfway through the head-to-head discussion. Just a reminder, I'm John Donvan, your host and moderator of this Intelligence Squared U.S. debate, where the motion is Google violates its Don't Be Evil motto. We have three debaters for and against, and we are at this point taking questions from the audience, and we have... Yes, I see you, madam.
Hi, I'm Megan Keenan with Wired.com. I'm just wondering about the Yahoo and Google search partnership. And did efforts to stop Google from forming a monopoly just end up speeding up the demise of its competitor? And if you all have any thoughts on, you know, who might be able to save Yahoo now that Yang stepped down?
Yeah, so on the question of demise, I mean, I think that the question is Microsoft, who wanted to buy Yahoo before, still a natural purchaser? Obviously, the scuttlebutt in today's newspapers and online is that the change in management yesterday may increase that possibility. So if you ask what the natural deal is, that's the natural deal. It's not obvious to me that deal will actually matter. Maybe Esther's in a better position to talk about that, but that seems to me the most natural next move for Yahoo.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There are other acquirers such as AOL, but I think the most important thing to learn from this is that companies that get into trouble usually are not murdered by Google or anybody else. They commit suicide.
Question from the gentleman in the center.
I confess to being the father of a daughter who works at Google also. I would like to ask the panel, either side of the question, where do the shareholders figure into this?
Are they evil, are you asking? Are the shareholders evil?
Well, in a certain sense, yes. And I'm asking that question. I'm asking what response. We're talking about Google as if it was an abstract drawing, okay, when in fact there are all these shareholders out there. And don't they have a voice in how the company behaves, or should they?
Esther.
I think Google feels, and I agree, that shareholders matter, but not a lot. If their interests are short-term profits, they can buy and sell and go away. What the founders wanted to create was a company where they were not driven shortly by short-term shareholder considerations. So they're driven to some extent by long-term shareholder considerations. They don't want to sell their shares. They want this thing to be worth a lot in the long run. And I would say that's the basic attitude.
But Harry Lewis, I think you are almost arguing in your China argument that you're disappointed that shareholders did not protest.
Oh, I think, yes, I think that Google's international reputation would have soared had they stood firmly against the Chinese censorship.
It would have been
in their long-term interests, as many of the other measures that Google has made had.
Jim Harper.
As to the shareholder question, this is very much like the question of people who complain about Google but don't do anything about it. Shareholders are free to sell, and they would if Google was evil, if they were violating their motto.
Unfortunately, they wouldn't, actually.
Esther, I don't think your mic was on. Can you make...
Yeah, I know. Unfortunately, I don't think the shareholders would have sold if they thought Google was evil. They're free to. I also don't think they would have applauded had Google stayed out of China. They probably would not have noticed, to be candid.
Siva?
Someone's been selling Google's shares.
They've been selling everybody's.
Well, exactly. But people have been selling Google shares for reasons they don't disclose, right? It's a simple signal they send to the market. Nonetheless, remember that a publicly traded company that's doing very well can afford to hold out a motto like, don't be evil. When things get tough, and as Harry's brought up, they have to make a decision between revenue and egalitarianism, they're going to pick revenue, as they have every time.
We are going to another question halfway up. Gentleman in the white shirt.
Yes, hi. I have no relationship with Google, other than being a Google user at times. So I wanted to just raise one point to the against side, that I have kind of a problem with the fact that, you know, you're basically, you seem, Esther, I believe, made the point that Google aspires to embrace it, or to live up to this motto, but I kind of feel like you're conflating aspiration with accomplishment, and I also feel like Jeff, you've kind of made the point that, well, just because Google has done 8 or 9 or 10 or 20 good things, that somehow would eliminate if they had done anything bad. But the question is that they violate the motto, which means that they commit actions that are evil, or acts of evil. The point that you know, the law professor here in the audience raised, of the fact that Google is adhering to legal norms in whatever market they belong to, raises the profound problem for me that Google itself has said that they aspire to be able to predict what we want to do before we know it ourselves. And with the accumulation of so much information from people which is not opted in, what if the government in some other place were to decide that Google needed to share that information with people?
I'm going
to
stop you there.
Or with the government itself.
And thank you for the question. And there were a few questions there. But, Jeff, did you had more of a challenge to your view than a question.
On the aspirational point, I think that your standard then is perfection. It is, in fact, godlike. Because what you're saying is that if you fail at anything beyond this pledge of being evil, you've somehow failed, and I don't think anyone here in reasonable mind would hold any of us or Google or anyone short of God to that. And so I also think that it's important that your other issue is that is this God Google omniscient? Does it know everything about us, and can that be tapped by someone else? I think it's a mistake to say, similarly, the opposite of the aspirational question, if that could happen, it ergo is true. If Google could do bad, ergo it is bad, or Google is big and big is often bad, ergo Google is bad, none of that follows.
Okay, and just for our radio audience, I just want to say Jeff Jarvis answering that question. Esther Dyson.
Yeah, just briefly, I want to respond to one thing you said and point out the real danger here is not Google, it's the government. And governments have power which can easily be abused. Google is constrained. It's constrained by law, it's constrained by competition, it's constrained by its users, and it responds to those constraints, and that's one reason it's not evil. But I think the other reason is it doesn't want to be.
Siva, can you be brief on this, because there is
very
a question.
Brief. So I actually want to echo what Esther said. And again, just because there are more evil institutions in the world than Google does not mean that our case, that they violated their motto, is not true, right? The fact that the federal government is much more evil does not absolve Google of responsibility of maintaining information that can be easily secretly gathered, right? If the FBI comes with a national security letter to Google and says, we want to know everything about Randy Picker, Randy Picker will never know that that happens, and no one at Google can talk about the fact that it happens, right? That's the black box we're dealing with. Google is a black box. The federal government is a black box. The interaction of two black boxes is a serious danger. That doesn't mean Google has done anything specifically actively evil, but it certainly has enabled the potential of real evil.
Question all the way in the back.
Hi, Kevin Williams, National Review, which may explain the slightly Thomistic tenor of this question. But this is really for those who are arguing for the motion. Aren't you arguing that Google is, in fact, violating a different motto, which would say don't do evil, versus a motto that says don't be evil? Every business makes some sort of compromise. Every business makes a mistake. Everybody who's ever paid a dollar in taxes has made a compromise with evil at some point.
That was it's staying theological, and it was a great question. Well, Harry Lewis for the motion.
Aren't you arguing against a different motto?
I was waiting for this Clintonian or Clinton-esque moment where the debate turned to the question of what the meaning of B is.
Are you going to take that question? I'm sorry, I was briefly distracted. I thought you were on a roll.
No, I was...
We're done.
I actually think there's something to the question.
The question calls for an assessment of the totality of the company, not picking out individual instances where you don't like what Google does, and we've made cases that there are many of those are falsities. The totality of the company invited this discussion, first of all, by having this motto, and now exposes itself to this kind of discussion. I think it holds up well, given all that. Yeah.
Well,
being evil means being evil in your heart, and they...
Harry Lewis.
Esther, if that's what they meant, Carter. They could have said it. They set the standard.
They're brief.
Set the standard.
Unlike lawyers, they're brief and succinct.
Question down front.
I'm Benny Mankowski. I don't have anything to do with Google, but I have two questions. One is for Harry Lewis, the other is for Siva.
He's going to ask you to choose one, okay?
That's difficult. Hard. Okay, no. let's go with the China one. Having lived for 20 years under communism in Bulgaria, and having been listening to the Voice of America and Free Europe, which were broadcasted by the U.S. mainly, and were... noised by the Bulgarian authorities as well as the Russian and everyone else in the East Bloc. According to what you say, the U.S. should not have actually radio transmitted Voice of America because our authorities were actually making noise on the same frequency. But I can tell you, if we didn't have access to this little information, we today would have not been members of NATO or the European Union. So how would you...
No. There isn't a parallel between the United States Voice of America and Google. Google is a business, and the issue for Google only came up because they wanted to set up shop inside China, have employees there, run their servers there, and do business with inside China. And there are rules inside China for how businesses have to operate. And if I can just respond to Professor Lessig's statement, I agree that businesses doing business in a country have to obey the laws of the country they're doing business in. And my contention is that Google made the wrong decision in deciding to do business in a country whose demands were so inconsistent with their fundamental mission in life.
So there's more evidence to how freedom breaks out in a country that I think people should consider. In Czechoslovakia, Václav Havel was a playwright, and he wrote very obscure plays that the authorities didn't understand well. But the fact that people went to the plays, they talked about them, they were talking about revolution, they were talking about freedom. Similar things are happening now with Google's help in China. They're using cultural references that the authorities don't understand and that Google and nobody else can control. They're using language, they're talking to each other, they're communicating with each other, and they're finding each other through Google. I'm not concerned about the...
Well, to be clear, Google is not actually the major search engine that's actually used in China. So there are other avenues.
I want to go to, in a little bit of time we have left, to get in two more questions up in the far right.
One of my questions about China was just addressed. My other question is about the Google Chrome browser, which allows it to collect personal advertising information. I was wondering how both sides of the motion felt that it could use this as a force for good or for evil.
The collection of personal information?
Yes, through the browser.
Is there, Esther, a good use of the collection of personal information?
Sure. It can if a user wants this information, can be extremely valuable for the user. The user may want to share that information with other people. People keep talking as if users' information was most ought to be secret. People are now going online voluntarily sharing it. They love comparing themselves. They like to compare their music tastes. They like to know whether they're hot or not. I like to compare my genome with other people's genomes. And the ability to know more about yourself, to share it with other people, that's what mirrors are for, and they're best sellers.
I'll show you my genome if you show me yours. Siva.
The issue behind privacy and the regulation of personal information is not that people should or should not or do not want to share. The issue is a matter of personal autonomy, having the easy-to-access controls over who sees what in what context. And it's a much more fluid, complicated, and multifaceted question than simply the idea that we are putting our favorite music up on Facebook in torrents. That's true, but it's not relevant. The fact is, Chrome and Gmail offer us no way to manage our personal information. Google service harvests that information, and people use Chrome and Gmail without any real knowledge or recognition or simple acknowledgement of the transaction. Most people who use Google do not understand the transaction in which they are engaging, and that is a problem.
Our last question from right down front. Make it a doozy.
I'd like some clarity on the definition of evil that we're using. If an entity has good goals and achieves them imperfectly, and such that some bad is caused by their imperfect achievement of those goals, is that evil? I don't see anything evil in spoiling your employees or in choosing to place some value on an ad-free search result such that it costs more for the advertisers. I potentially see evil in the decision to censor the results in China if that was a decision made for the goal of financial return.
But at bottom, you're asking what?
Do we have any way of knowing what Google's goals are in making these decisions? And if we don't, do we have any way of evaluating whether or not they're evil?
Siva.
We each have the capacity of judging whether any particular action is evil. I, of course, am appealing to authority, one of the classic fallacies, the authority being Dante and Pope Gregory. But I didn't mean to do so quite so facetiously. I do mean to say that all of the things that big, successful corporations should do tend to trample on the canon of good and evil that we have been swimming in. And in fact, it's hypocritical for a company to say that it will hold itself to such a high standard. It's perfectly reasonable for Google to do almost everything it has done as a profit-making venture, and I applaud most of what it's done. But the real question is this standard itself being undermined by its very actions? Is the fact that it set this high standard for itself ultimately foolish?
Thank you very much. And that includes the head-to-head portion of the discussion. And thanks for your terrific questions, which actually were quite good questions and kept things moving along. We're going to move along now to final statements. This is the last chance that each of the panelists will have, really, to lock you in. They'll each get 2 minutes to speak. But before we do that, I want to remind you of where we were in terms of the numbers. Before the debate, when we polled you on the motion that Google violates its "Don't Be Evil" motto, 21% of you were for the motion, 31% were against, and a very large 48% were undecided. So we're moving forward now to closing statements. Each panelist will have 2 minutes, and we are going to begin with Jim Harper, who is the Director of Information Policy Studies at the Cato Institute, speaking against the motion. Jim?
Well, first I want to congratulate and thank our opponents in this debate. They had a very, very difficult tour ahead of them. They did the best they could, and I congratulate them on what meager success they had in our arguments. Important point. Google invited this conversation. Google deserves your credit for having invited this conversation. And as Jeff pointed out, inviting this conversation internally as well. There is a culture there that is essentially good. There are decisions they have made that I have openly criticized. I disagree with some of the things Google does. The totality of what Google does and the totality of what Google is not evil. It is good. And I think you should support opposing the motion. You should oppose the motion. Because Google is, at its heart, a good company that provides extraordinary services to the public, that makes extraordinary amounts of information available to the public, is working around the world to make information available. And the slights that have been heaped upon it by our opponents do not overcome their burden. We think, and we hope you think, that that Google is a good company. Please oppose the motion.
Thank you, Jim Harper. In making his summarizing statement for the motion, Randy Picker, professor at the University of Chicago Law School. Randy Picker.
Well, I'm both a lawyer and an economist, and as an economist, I think the issue before us is what I'll call marginal evil, or incremental evil. I think that's where we are with regard to Google. That's the question. When are they creating evil that they don't need to create? When are they making a choice that we should understand to be one that benefits Google and hurts the market, hurts other participants in that market? Where I started was something that went to the heart of their business model. This isn't a sideshow. This is not an experiment. This is at the heart of the way Google does business. And what they are doing there is doing exactly what we see monopolists doing since the Sherman Act was passed in 1890. They exercise market power. That's what Google is doing. We've heard a lot of discussion. I haven't heard actually anything about that. I think that's because it's not possible to refute that, and I don't think it's actually transparent to most people how they're doing it. And when someone asks Google whether they're doing that, Google says, we're running auctions, we don't have power, notwithstanding our market share is 65% in the United States. That is acting in a way that is being evil.
Thank you, Randall Picker. Summarizing against the motion, Esther Dyson, an investor in information technology companies. Esther Dyson.
Thank you. The thing doesn't say don't be incrementally evil. When you have to sort of get down to these fine distinctions, I think it's clear you're losing. So I would encourage you guys to join the winning side and vote against this unsupportable proposition. Google is not violating its don't be evil motto. They are doing good. They're opening up the world. They're giving people more choices. They're giving people awareness of their choices. They're increasing transparency and people's personal autonomy. Mostly what they are doing, and the thing for which I give them the most credit, is they're eroding the power and limiting the ability of those in power to abuse that power by shining light and by encouraging people to change their expectations, to start asking for answers. They're giving everyone the ability to watch the watchers in this increasingly transparent world. So please join us, the winning side, and vote no.
Thank you, Esther Dyson. Summarizing his position for the motion, Harry Lewis, professor of computer science at Harvard University.
Well, not everyone, Esther. They're not giving that power to everyone. Evil was Google's terms. We didn't set the terms of this debate. The Intelligence Squared people didn't set the terms of this debate. Google set the terms of this debate by putting that grand proposition out there, don't be evil. Some of the things they're doing, they themselves know aren't right. They themselves would prefer not to be censoring search results in China. And they have allied themselves with other corporations into a new consortium and they've pledged themselves to try to lift this restriction over the coming years. Now, that's, they're to be respected for that, as they are to be respected for all of the other enlightening things that the other side keeps pointing out they are doing. But it's not a proposition about, on aggregate, are they 10% more good than they are evil. The question is, do they violate? Violate is an active verb. Let's not parse. Do they violate their don't be evil motto? And I would just repeat that the construction of censorship tools is an act of evil. Thank you.
Okay, the motion in this Intelligence Squared US debate is Google violates its don't be evil motto, and summarizing his position against the motion is Jeff Jarvis, director of the International Journalism Program at the City University of New York's Graduate School of Journalism. Jeff Jarvis.
This debate, I believe, is not about Google. It is about us. And it is perhaps a bit of an indictment of us. You know, the problem we have in America is that we love and nurture success until you become too successful. And when you become too successful, we become suspicious of you. We even wonder whether you couldn't do this any other way besides being evil. Perhaps you do it by being smart, by being good, by being generous, by being innovative. I think that's what Google has done here. I think those are all virtues. And our risk as a nation by looking the gift geek in the mouth, not a pleasant visual, I'll admit, is that we lose this lesson and we lose this value and we lose this tremendous gift that Google gives us. Finally, because I am a fan of Google, I am a fan of the wisdom of the crowd. I believe you are wise. So I am confident that you will vote against the motion.
Thank you, Jeff Jarvis. And finally, summarizing his position for the motion, Siva Vaidyanathan, Associate Professor of Media Studies and Law at the University of Virginia. Siva.
Lucifer did not fall because he wanted to be bad. Like Jessica Rabbit, he was drawn that way. In fact, he fell because he was trying to be great. Now, I firmly believe that companies should be companies, that governments should be governments, that saints should be saints, that sinners should be sinners, that gods should be gods, and devils should be devils. The claims of corporate responsibility are basically cynical marketing ploys, disguised as something great and good. The fact is, Google grew as big and successful as it has, not only because it is great, and it is, but because it claimed to be good. Google never bought a Super Bowl ad. To my knowledge, Google never bought an ad, right? Google got big because in the early days, a whole lot of us who were very active on the web were disgusted by the status quo, and we gravitated to Google, not only because it seemed to satisfy our needs, but because it satisfied our need to avoid evil, and the evil in those days was number one, Microsoft, and number two, Yahoo. And in both cases, Google was able to gain our loyalty. It was a cynical marketing ploy, one that in the long run, it will not, and in fact has not, lived up to. People really believed it was not evil. Many people still believe it does not do evil. The fact is, companies should make money, and the rest of us should beware. So please vote for the proposition.
Thank you, Siva Vaidyanathan. And I'd just like to ask for a round of applause as we conclude the talking portion of the debate. So now we come to the moment where you decide how this all turns out. We are going to ask you to vote on the motion, which I will restate once again. Google violates its "Don't Be Evil" motto. Turn to the keypads by your side. If you agree with the motion, push number one. If you disagree, number two. If you remain undecided, push number three. And we're going to have the results actually hurried down in just a moment. And as they're tallied, I would like to point out a few things that are coming up on Intelligence Squared. Our final debate of the fall season, as you've jumped ahead of me, it's Tuesday, December 22nd, our final debate. With the motion, Bush 43 is the worst president of the last 50 years. Panelists for the motion are Simon Jenkins, a columnist for The Guardian and former editor at The Times and London Evening Standard, and Jacob Weisberg, who is chairman and editor-in-chief of The Slate Group. Against the motion, Bill Kristol, editor of The Weekly Standard and op-ed columnist for The New York Times, and Karl Rove, former senior advisor and deputy chief of staff for George W. Bush. This is all your way of reminding the radio audience that we are in New York City. This debate will be broadcast on BBC World News Television, and to accommodate this particular taping, we will be moving for this debate to the Symphony Space Theater, which is at 95th and Broadway. And for more information, you can visit our website. I would also like to announce the dates and motions for our spring 2009 season. January 13th, major reductions in carbon emissions are not worth the money. February 3rd, the art market is less ethical than the stock market. March 17th, blame Washington more than Wall Street for the financial crisis. April 21st, it is wrong to pay for sex. May 12th, diplomacy with Iran is going nowhere. All of the spring debates will be held here again at the Caspary Auditorium at Rockefeller University, with the exception of the first debate on January 13th. That is the carbon debate. That will also be held at the Symphony Space Theater, and tickets are still available through the website. All of our debates can be heard on more than 150 NPR stations around the country, and you just need to check with your local NPR station listings for the dates and times of the broadcast. And copies of books by our panelists are on sale in the lobby, as well as DVDs. And now, the moment of truth. The motion before us was Google violates its Don't Be Evil motto. Coming in, 21% of you were for the motion, 31% were against, and 48% were undecided. After the debate, 47% of you agree with the motion. Forty-seven percent of you are against the motion, and 6% were undecided. 47% to 47% looks like a tie. However, the side that changed most minds is the side for the motion, who moved 26% of you versus 16% for the side against. Thank you to our panelists, and thank all of you for joining us.